It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's Italy beyond Tuscany. We're going to a region that's evocative, luscious, and unknown. Guaranteed you're not going to run into your Pilates instructor over dinner. Our guide is Italian food and culture authority Fred Plotkin, owner of the famed Plotkin Nose. It's Chicago for the Sterns, but no hot dogs. This time they tuck into a Wunderkind chicken with 18 soulful vegetables. The master chef of the herb garden has new herbal cocktails. Then it's a vacation memoir, trying to blend a family over the broken fantasy of an island in Maine. We have a new round of Stump the Cook, and it's a new perfume, as in smelling like your cheese tray. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Just before our love got lost, you said, I am as constant as a northern star. And I said, constantly in the darkness, where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar. On the back of a cartoon coaster, in the blue of a TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada. Oh, Canada. With your face sketched on it twice, I could drink a case of you. I would still be on my feet. I would still. A box of paints. I'm frightened by the devil, but I'm drawn to those ones that ain't. I remember the time you told me, you said, love is touching souls. Well, surely you've touched mine. Part of you pours out of me in these lines from time to time. You're in my blood like holy wine. You're so bitter, baby, and so sweet. I could drink. She knew your deeds, and she said, go with it and stay with it, but be prepared to bleed. 'Cause could drink a kiss of you, darling. Still I'd be on my feet. I would still be on my feet.
Rosetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today it's a new part of Italy to explore, at least new to most of we Americans. Italian food and culture expert Fred Plotkin talks eating our way through the Marche region. Now, you've got the charm equal to Tuscany without a tourist on every corner. Fred's author of Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. Master chef of the herb garden, Jerry Traunfeld, has a new take on cocktails. First you get your herbs, then you get your booze. Poet and journalist Cynthia Zarin tells a vacation story, how a fantasy island in Maine turned into what could be called the culinary version of Survivor. We have a new round of our refrigerator game, Stump the Cook. It's presided over by celebrity stump master Christopher Kimball. And then from those great folks who brought you Stinky Stilton cheese, it's the latest in perfume. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number's 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, Michael has finally relented on visiting Chicago and eating nothing but hot dogs and Italian beef. We actually got to eat at a wonderful chicken restaurant called Feed.
We were totally shocked to find ourselves in a very forlorn neighborhood in Humboldt Park at the intersection of Chicago and California, and to see a restaurant there with a sort of chicken theme on all the signs outside, like silhouettes of chickens, profiles of chickens. Uh-huh. It looked kind of cute and maybe a little overly cute, but we couldn't resist going inside. And let me tell you, what we found there is just kind of a road fooder's dream, in the sense that it's a place that does soul food, by which I mean there's a list of maybe a dozen to 18 different soulfully cooked vegetables that are available on the side of their delicious Wonder Roast with one R in the middle, rotisserie chicken.
And it is an adorable little room that features, when you walk in, you know, Lynn, I'll tell you, I'm crazy for these things, like an old-fashioned, probably from the 1940s, Lucky Egg chicken machine, and you put a quarter
yes.
in it, and if you're lucky, you get the golden egg, which
yeah.
means you get a free meal there. But even if you don't get the golden egg, this machine starts, like, clucking and hopping around. It's a riot.
So now, the 18 vegetables, what kinds of things?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what we had. Or, Michael, do you want to say what you had?
I'll tell you what I saw. What you step up to the counter and place your order at the counter in this restaurant. So when you're standing there, you can kind of see what's on the stove. What we saw on the stove that was just irresistible was whole roasted ears of corn, you know, with the husks just kind of pulled back, cooking over charcoal and brushed with a kind of garlic butter. Let me tell you, that was something delicious.
Spicy whipped potatoes with sweet potatoes made from scratch, hand-cut French fries.
Macaroni and cheese to die for.
It was just...
Oh, and the collard greens. Now, Jane is not such a collard green fanatic as I am. These were really porky collard greens. I mean, rich as a pork roast.
And if you're not a chicken eater, although I can't imagine who's not a chicken eater, you can get pulled pork there, which
that
is also
great.
Terrific. And banana pudding for dessert. I mean, Michael finally got away from Chicago hot dogs and Italian beef long enough for me to eat something else. It was delicious.
Oh, you're suffering so
I'm
much
suffering
from the hot
so
dogs
much.
And
poor
Italian
baby.
Beef.
But, you know, what is a Wonder Roast chicken?
it's a rotisserie chicken. I don't know. I think Wonder Roast refers to maybe the spices that they brush on it while it rotisserizes. I don't really know, but it's a beautiful kind of burnished bird with that kind of extremely plump look and the skin that if you kind of just poke it with a fork, juices drip out.
I do love the name One. It's like W-O-N-D-E-R-O-S-T. It's kind of like you need a biscuit.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Wonder Roast. I mean, it's one of those great 1940s names.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Cluck, cluck.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Chayne and Michael Stern are authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know, go to the website, splendidtable.org. So it's summer, and a hungry woman's mind turns toward thoughts of cheese. I mean, this is great milk season. I've tasted a few standouts. Cowgirl Creamery, which is outside San Francisco, does an organic cheese called Red Hawk. It resembles brie, but it's earthier and deeper flavored. We had it with peaches. This is a good one. I have this idea of the all-purpose cheese. It's nutty with a sense of sweetness, and it's mellow. It's the cheese that you snack on straight out of the fridge. You melt it on a cracker, or you could take it seriously and serve it at room temperature, you know, in the correct way. Well, I have a new candidate. It's called Serena, and it comes from Three Sisters Farmstead, which is also in California. The cheese is firm, and it tastes like a cross between a Parmigiano and a Gruyere. Now, this is one that I really like with pistachio nuts, and maybe it's an insult to such serious cheese making, but I shredded it over buttered cobs of corn. Died and went to heaven. Well, we've got the two cheeses on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week we send you a new recipe designed to make your worknight suppers a little easier. And this week there's a bonus part to the recipe, a southwestern rub. We also have a weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. You're going to find it all and so much more on the website, splendidtable.org. Award-winning chef Jerry Traunfeld is the king when it comes to herbs. He's chef of the Herb Farm restaurant outside Seattle. Now, Jerry has this simple yet totally original sense of cooking with herbs. His latest book is The Herbal Kitchen, Cooking with Fragrance and Flavor. Jerry, it's good to have you back with us.
It's great to be here with you again.
You know, Jerry, I was interested to see that you have an entire section of the book that you call Botanical Beverages. Herbs in drinks. Can you talk a little about this?
Right. Sure. Well, you know, it's really quite a trend. You know, you go to any kind of hip, you know, cocktail lounge or restaurant bar across the country, and you're really likely to see the cocktails with herbs in them. And I'm not just talking about mint. I'm talking about things like basil and lemongrass and lavender.
Yeah, yeah.
And even, you know, even sage and rosemary. It's just, it's really prevalent.
So what have you done with this?
Well, you know, at the Herb Farm restaurant, we've actually been doing our own version for many years, and that's a very simple one, and it's one of my favorites, and it's our herbal champagne cocktail. And what we do is, as people sit down in the dining room, we go around with a basket of living herb plants, and we go around to each guest and ask them to choose one of them for their cocktail. So it might be lemon verbena, it might be lavender or rose geranium, and we take a little piece of the leaf, crush it in their glass, and then we fill it with a champagne or a sparkling wine. And it's wonderful because it doesn't mask the flavor of the wine itself. It just adds this wonderful nuance and this little fragrance as you're sipping the cocktail.
You know, I'm just thinking, there's my centerpiece. I've got the herb plants. It's a great idea for a dinner party.
Yeah, it is great.
How do you get the flavor into the drink? Or I mean, you can put in the herb, as you're just describing, but there are other ways of doing it too.
Yeah, there are two basic ways. One is making syrups, and the other is by muddling herbs. And I'm sure many people have had a mojito, which is a wonderful drink with rum and mint. And the mint is muddled in the glass, meaning you just put it in the glass, and there's actually a tool called a muddler, but you could use anything like the end of a rolling pin. It's just sort of a piece of wood, like a little tiny baseball bat. Uh-huh. And you just smash it, and it releases all the essential oils. And then you add, in a mojito, you would add, you know, rum and sparkling water.
Right.
But there's all kinds of variations you can do. There's one that we do that I love, which is our ultimate lemon drop. And for this, you take lemon verbena and you muddle it in a glass with lemons. And then you add lemon-flavored vodka. And
Sounds so good. Right?
So you have really a kind of a triple whammy of the lemon. Also, a really simple one is a rosemary gin tonic. You can just take a piece of lime and a sprig of rosemary. Mm-hmm. You muddle it in the glass, and then you add your gin and tonic. You get this wonderful fragrance as you're sipping, you know, with the little bubbles from the tonic.
I would never have thought to blend lime and rosemary. Lemon and rosemary, you think about all the time, but that mm-hmm. sounds like it'd be fresh, really bright. Oh, it sounds
great
delicious.
Summer drink.
Yeah,
great summer drink.
Yeah.
A third one that I really love is sage rush. And sage might not be a herb you would think of first of all in a, you know, herbal cocktail, but
right.
it has a real affinity. It's a very herbaceous flavor, real affinity for something like gin, which already has botanicals in it.
Mm-hmm.
So for this, I take lemon and sage and muddle it in a glass. And then I add gin and grapefruit juice. And then you shake it with ice and pour it into a little cocktail glass. And it just has a really sophisticated flavor.
This sounds like a sort of a mm-hmm. new take on the martini.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said there were two things. This is muddling. What about the other?
Well, the other is syrups.
This is sugar and water.
Right, sugar and water. Usually it's about two parts sugar, one part water.
Right.
Bring it to a boil, and then you add the herb and let it steep. So there's a wonderful non-alcoholic beverage I like to do, which is rosemary lemonade. Very simple, and you can just infuse that sugar-water mixture with the rosemary, just steep it like a tea, and then use that to sweeten your lemonade. And it's really a bracing, wonderful summer drink.
It sounds so good. I've tried to do a basil syrup, and it turns the color of awful.
Right. Well, actually, there's a little trick to that. And when I make my basil syrup, I first blanch the basil. So you plunge it into a pot of boiling water. And then you, just for about 10 seconds, you pull it out, you put it in some ice water. And that really sets the color. Then I just put it in a blender with sugar and water. And the other trick is a little pinch of baking soda. And the reason you do that, you know, have you ever cooked greens with, like, you know, spinach with lemon juice, and it just turns
this
really
the acid just turns greens to olive drab. They look like army uniforms. Yeah.
Right. So what you want to do is make that syrup alkaline. And so the baking soda does that. So a little pinch just really sets that color. And you just blend it all together in a blender. And then you can, if you want it real smooth, you can strain it through a fine strainer. And when I have that syrup, one of my favorite drinks with basil is a basil lime fizz. Again, another non-alcoholic drink. And you just take a little bit of that syrup, mm-hmm. Put it in a glass with some lime juice, and fill it with sparkling water. And you have this fantastic, beautiful, bright green summer drink.
Oh, sounds wonderful. Hey, Jerry, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
Jerry Traumfeld is chef at the Herb Farm restaurant outside Seattle, and he's author of The Herbal Kitchen. Jerry left us with the cocktail recipe for Sage Rush. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, pleasure activist Fred Plotkin on the Italian region nobody knows, and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Italy beyond Tuscany. Now, believe it or not, somewhere in the 19 regions beyond Tuscany, there are gems to see. Places where you will not meet other Americans in every restaurant. Now, Italian food authority Fred Plotkin knows Italy the way you know your neighborhood. Fred is an obsessive scholar of Italian food, culture, and history, and he possesses the famous Plotkin nose. Fred can literally sniff out that wondrous trattoria that's hidden in an alley with nary a sign in sight. He's author of Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. Fred, it's good to have you back.
Wonderful to be back. I have a clip on my nose just now so that I can focus on listening.
But talking about beyond Tuscany, where would you have us go that places we normally would not get to on our own?
Well, there are so many regions. There's the Alto Adige, there's Molise, there's Basilicata, but the place I'm going this year is the Marche. Now, everyone at home, raise your hand if you know where that is. No one does.
Exactly.
The Marche is in central Italy. It borders on Emilia-Romagna, it borders on Umbria, and it borders on Tuscany, three of the most visited regions. Yet no one knows it. And what makes it distinct is it's right on the Adriatic, so it has magnificent fish and seafood, but it's all mountains and hills. It's 69% hills, 31% mountains, and just the shore. So what you have there is a cuisine that combines magnificent stuff from the sea with gorgeous products from the land, excellent wine, and a native cuisine that has not been corrupted by fancy tourism or outside influences.
So why don't you describe the food?
Well, there are pigs and sheep and cattle, but I guess I'm going to start with a dish that is very famous only in the region and nowhere else. Vincis Grassi, V-I-N-C-I-G-R-A-S-S-I. Now, that sounds in Italian like victory over fat, but
yes,
it's anything
it does.
But. It's a lasagna, and it contains cream as the first ingredient, veal ragu, chicken giblets, black truffles, fresh tomatoes, butter, parmigiano reggiano, mozzarella, and many other items. And the name comes from an Austrian military man who occupied the town of Macerata in 1790. His name was Vincis Grassi, which the Italians couldn't say, so he became Vincis Grassi. Now, you eat that once in Macerata, and then you really have to go climbing lots of hills and valleys to work it all off.
If you haven't died first, but it's delicious.
If you haven't died first.
It's utterly delicious.
But, oh, it's fantastic. But most of the cuisine of the region is not that fatty. In fact, the people of the Marche tie the Ligurians for living the longest of any region of Italy. And the other thing about the Marche, most Italians agree these are the best-looking people in Italy. Now, that's saying something in Italy.
Yes, it
they're
sure
just
is.
Gorgeous. There's something in the food and in the gene pool, but they're just beautiful to look at, and that's another reason to go. But the other great dish, among many, is brodetto, which is a seafood stew, and you find it up and down the Adriatic, but it's at its peak in the Marche. Now, the capital of the Marche is named Ancona, and nearby is a town called Numana. It's the dividing line for different types of brodetto. From Numana north, it's a stew made with 13 types of fish, untoasted bread rubbed with garlic and a dash of vinegar. South of Numana, it's made with 9 types of fish, which are floured, and it thickens the soup. It also has saffron, and the bread slices are not rubbed with garlic. So these little details are important, but the key thing is no crustaceans, just fish.
Ah. The thing, too, about the Marche is it's utterly beautiful to see. But where would you have us set up base camp?
I would have you set up camp in Urbino, which is one of the great Renaissance towns anywhere. If you know that famous painting by Piero della Francesca of the guy with the broken nose, that is Federico, the Duke of Montefeltro, and he set up base in Urbino, created a duchy that was the best of all possible worlds. With his good luck, Raphael was born there and began painting there early on, so that His early works are in the National Gallery of the Marche, which is right there in Urbino. The other thing in Urbino, apart from the fantastic food and the beautiful town and the great art, is there is a local cheese which may be, along with Parmigiano Reggiano, the best cheese in Italy. And it's called Formaggio di Fossa, which fossa means sort of a cave or a hidden spot.
Mm-hmm.
And you take, or they took in older times, sheep's milk cheese, and they would put it in a cave and surround it with herbs. And this was not for food purposes, but to hide the cheese from someone who would steal it. The result is that in the cave, the cheese would age in a particular way, get a slightly pungent smell on it, but then the herbs would give it a different fragrance. It is divine, and you almost never find it outside of this part of Italy, and if you do, it's not very good. They save the best for themselves, and there's a restaurant called Vecchio Urbino, and they have their own cave, and they produce their own cheese. It's heaven. Michelangelo, I'm writing a book about him now, when he got rich, he bought a cave near Urbino and had cheeses put in there for him to enjoy. They would be shipped to Florence or shipped to Rome. And while he was sculpting, he would nibble on the Formaggio di Fossa, eat pears, and drink white wine. Trebbiano was his wine.
A man of great taste. Fred, thank you.
Thank you.
Fred Plotkin is author of Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. Now, for information on his updated edition and his recipe from the Marche region, shrimp wrapped in prosciutto, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Perfect sunsets, joyful families coming together around the cosmic picnic table. The dreams of vacations. We try not to do it, but before we step out the door, the traps are set. So much pressure to accomplish so much delight in a few short days. Poet and journalist Cynthia Zarin's dream was a fantasy island.
At first, it was the name, Swan's Island. Charming house on cove, three bedrooms, beautiful views, ferry from Southwest Harbor. Secretly, on reading the ad, I embarked on a fantasy. I called the owner of the house. He sent pictures which would turn out to be misleading in the extreme. It was our second summer together, and that may have accounted for its feeling of frantic fancy. We were trying to fit two halves of two different families together, my daughter and me, and my husband and his two children. The summer before, we had taken ourselves to Cape Cod, to the village where I had spent every summer as a child. We had no idea then that the cottage we rented that summer would become the fulcrum of our new-made life, but that first year we knew the month had been a success, so much so that by winter we decided to trifle with it. I have a clear memory of that ferry trip to Swan's Island, notable for its absence of foreboding. The children, excited and famished, are standing in the prow of the boat, and I am sitting nearby wearing a large straw hat, pinned down against the breeze, unwrapping chicken salad sandwiches. As we neared the dock, I noted that a number of cars were packed with grocery bags, but my eye moved on. After all, I had provisions, too. Pasta, cheese, olive oil, a bag of pistachio to have with drinks, a few bottles of wine. The ferry docked. We drove off into the sharp air, pungent with diesel fuel. About a mile down the road, we found the house. Tidy, trim, wiped almost murderously clean of other lives. Not even a packet of salt or a seashell remained. The owner of the cottage had left a map marked with the location of the grocery store and the historical society. Later, I was to reflect that these were in respects one and the same. We piled into the car, still packed with our swimsuits. A few minutes later, I stood in front of the vegetable bin. It contained three molting cabbages and a few wormy potatoes. Too late, I read the message of those grocery bags on the ferry. Dismay hit. What would we eat? This trip had been my idea, and my ideas about it had been extravagant. In particular, I had a reverence bordering on fetishistic for the food we would eat together on summer holidays. I had tended it over the winter, when the children slumped at the table, tired from traveling like small pilgrims between two households. The food we ate in the summer needed to sustain us all year. A quick survey of the edible contents of the store yielded milk, Rice Krispies, reconstituted orange juice, salted butter, eggs, frozen peas, sliced ham, ketchup, and potato chips. No joy was had from a question to the clerk about fresh meat or chicken. A query about fresh vegetables met with a shrug. Back at the house, we found a corkscrew, opened the wine, and ate the pistachio nuts. The children were delighted with the chips. For supper, we tucked into pasta with peas and grated cheese. Afterwards, I considered the options. Cheese omelets, more pasta, peanut butter. I had not yet realized next door lived a lobsterman. No snapshot could have conveyed that our neighbor, whom I'll call Frank, played Elvis tunes full blast on his tape deck at 4 a.m. When he returned to the dock, my husband greeted him. They bargained. In the 6 days that remained to us in Maine, we ate lobster 5 times. Perhaps because Frank realized he was ruining our sleep, they were cheap. We ate lobster boiled, sautéed, and grilled. We ate lobster salad with mayonnaise I made from the olive oil and ancient grocery store eggs. It is true, I think, that if you like to cook, you can make do with almost anything, but monotony is trying. The children ate more pasta and more peanut butter. We were a family that always ate at home with the children, but on Wednesday we found the island's one restaurant. It was a little shack perched precariously over a stony inlet. We were the only customers. The eldest read aloud from the plastic menu. I'm not sure what I'd had in mind. Maine bouillabaisse, oysters with wasabi, fish fingers, fried chicken. The hot dogs we finally ordered arrived obscenely bare, accompanied by cottony white rolls. We tried gnawing at them. After that sad supper, I gave in. We broke off hunks of cheddar cheese, drank up the wine. The children had recoiled from lobster, and by Thursday, so did we. Whatever point I wanted to make at the table crumbled. There was something to be said, even I could see, for ice cream for supper. That week in Maine, we didn't, of course, have nothing to eat. What we didn't have was food grown in the earth with the sun on it, and work for a cook with time on her hands and a family to grow and feed. After that week, we drove to the Cape. We went straight to the farm stand, and I bought 5 pounds of late tomatoes to roast in the battered oven for the smell. While they cooked, I sat on the porch and looked down at the dune covered with rose hips, out of which the children I knew would make undrinkable tea, and thought of the silvery beach on Swan's Island, with its minaret carpet of sea urchins and its straight pines like furred fish bones. When we go back, I thought, we'll bring provisions. But we have not.
Cynthia Zarin's story, Fantasy Island, appeared in the August 2006 supplement to Gourmet magazine. It's time to play Stump the Cook, our refrigerator game, and we are playing with our celebrity stump master, Christopher Kimball, of Cook's Illustrated magazine fame and the star and host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. Chris, welcome back, and I hope you're not going to be tough this week.
You know, this is my career. I'm now a celebrity stump master. I knew it would come to this.
Okay, Chris, can you run us through the rules?
Yeah, there are 3 rules, simple enough. There are 5 things in our guest's refrigerator, and you're going to have to cook a meal out of those, an edible meal, by the way. Make sure that's in there.
Mm-hmm.
You get a free pass on water, salt and pepper, and some sort of oil. Plus, you get 3 other ingredients that are, in fact, in our guest's kitchen. And with all of that, you have to make a wonderful dish that I will either say is worth eating or not worth eating.
Okay.
So we have Amy on the line from Pinehurst, North Carolina. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. So what's in the fridge?
In my refrigerator, I have...
Okay, wait a minute. My pencil is poised here. Go ahead.
Okay. Beef liver.
Okay.
One can of goat's milk.
One can goat's milk.
Fresh spinach.
Fresh spinach.
Monterey Jack cheese.
Monterey Jack cheese.
And whole wheat bulgur.
Holy, you are one
this
healthy
is...
woman. Holy cow.
For $10, I have a solution. 15.
Chris, are you telling me that you actually have a solution to this?
I might. You're nice to me.
All right. I think let me try to do this on my own, and then we'll see what happens. We got beef liver, canned goat's milk, fresh spinach, Monterey Jack cheese, and whole wheat bulgur. This is the I've got it. I would like to have, and I've got olive oil I can use. Do you have olive oil in the house?
I sure do.
Okay. All right. This is great. We've got olive oil. I'm going to want some garlic. I always want garlic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think what I'd like to do is have some raisins, please.
Okay. I have raisins.
That's wonderful. Okay. Here's what we're going to do. We are going to moisten the bulgur because the bulgur is cooked in reality. It just needs to be moistened and fluffed.
Okay.
And we're going to moisten that with the one can of goat's milk.
Very good.
I knew you thought of that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's where I was going.
You know, all those years doing Cooks Illustrated, it's rubbed off, Chris.
Yeah. You learned something?
Yeah, I think so. And what I thought was, if we need more liquid, wouldn't it be nice to have a little broth in there?
I have some homemade vegetable broth.
You are really good, girl.
I'm frugal.
Wow. No, but this is wonderful. Okay, so what I want you to do is warm the goat's milk in the vegetable broth, and I want you to put the bulgur in there, and I want you to cook it until the bulgur is bulked, is plumped, and still has a nice nuttiness. Keep that warm. Slice the beef liver into finger-sized sticks, you know, pieces, all right?
Okay.
And what we're going to do is first take a really big skillet, film it with olive oil, okay? Slice some garlic in there and saute it very lightly, and then throw the spinach in and salt and pepper and the raisins and let that wilt down a little bit, okay?
Okay.
Take that out. Keep it warm on a platter. It should be a bright, bright green. You know, they're just wilted. Okay?
Okay.
Wipe out the skillet. Put in a little bit more oil. And obviously, you're salt and peppering things as you go along. A few more slivers of garlic. And you're going to get the pan pretty hot. And you're going to take those fingers of beef liver and you're going to toss them rather quickly until they're just firm. Because the point is, we don't want to overcook them. We want them pink inside. Not raw, but pink.
Okay.
Salt and pepper that. Put that on top of the spinach, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then do 3 or 4 lovely piles of the bulgur. And then I'd like you to shred the Monterey Jack cheese over the bulgur.
That sounds good.
And then so you've got a bed of this emerald spinach, the beef liver, and you could even shred some of the cheese over the beef liver, but you've got then this sort of wheat, you know, those wheaten-colored bulgur with the shredded white cheese.
You know, Lynn, I think I paid $35 for this at Michael's in L.A. a couple of years ago. This is very familiar.
Did I pass?
Amy's getting it for free. Yeah, it's an A. Yeah, you're a winner.
Thank you, sir.
Absolutely.
Amy, seriously, though, it sounds like you really love to cook, don't you?
I do. I spend most of my time in the kitchen.
Oh, boy. This sounds like a great list of stuff and a great refrigerator.
Canned goat's milk? I mean, you know.
Fabulous. Thanks for playing Stump the Cook.
Great job. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And I'll pay you off later, Chris. Bye.
No problem.
Our guest celebrity stump master is Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cooks Illustrated and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, if you want to challenge me in Stump the Cook, please give us a call, 800-537-5252. One of our canny producers may call you to be on the show. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. Who do you pray to when your knives are dull? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, who do you pray to when your knives are dull? Well, you pray to St. Eligius. He's patron saint of knife makers, who I figure must cover dull knives. You know, being raised Catholic, I learned that there's a specific saint hanging out, waiting to help you in almost any situation. Now, there's a clutch of them to appeal to from the kitchen. Saint Antonio and Abate is the protector of farm animals, especially the pig. Irish Saint Brigan covers cheeses and dairy foods. Saint Elizabeth of Hungary is standing by to help you with baking problems. And when the kitchen goes off kilter, think of San Pasquale, who supposedly protects the entire domain. Now, for a good party, call on Saint Julian. Hospitality is his specialty. Now, we cooks have an especially troubling saint. He's Saint Lawrence. And he is saint of cooks because he was literally grilled by the Romans. But what's truly odd is that he is also patron saint of comedians. What a guy.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
It's time for your calls, brought to you by Hefty OneZip. Pick up that phone, guys. Number's 800-537-5252. Okay, let's get rolling. We have got Barbara on the line from Louisville. Hey, Barbara, what do you want to talk about?
Tuna. But I would like to know what I could do with it, to add some spices, some herbs, to do something with it.
Okay. And do you eat it with spring water or with olive oil?
Spring.
Okay. I think, first of all, you're right. We tend to think of tuna, and what we tend to think of is the mayonnaise and the celery.
Right.
Which, personally, I love. But I know what you mean. It can get boring. And what I'm thinking is, why don't you take the tuna kind of on a trip? This is what I'm thinking.
Okay.
For instance, in the Mediterranean, southern Italy, Spain, etc., people will toss it with olive oil, olives, capers, chopped parsley, fresh basil, bits of tomato, and they make a salad out of it. It's utterly delicious, really delicious. And you can even let that sit in the fridge because it only gets better. You know, and use really good black olives that you cut up, like Kalamata olives, which you can get in supermarkets now,
yeah.
And capers and tomatoes. In Mexico, again, you could add black beans. You could add fresh corn or even canned corn. You could add a bit of chopped cilantro, chilies, and it could be very mild chilies. You could add sweet red pepper. Do you see where I'm going with this? And you could add some salsa. And boy, you eat that with a good corn tortilla or a whole wheat flour tortilla. That's really delicious. That's a lovely meal.
You inspired me.
Yeah, but that's... Because
it can be pretty drab with just mayonnaise.
That's right. And then in southern France, there's the famous salade niçoise, which is the tuna that's been packed in olive oil with sliced potatoes on the plate and cooked green beans and lots of lettuce and oil and vinegar. And that's it. And it's so simple. And olives. It's so simple, but it is the best salad. It is just delicious. So you got a lot of choices.
It is. I love it.
Hey.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. You can do a great deal with a can of tuna fish. And I forgot to tell her about the pasta where you toss the tuna. You saute garlic and onion with parsley, okay? And you toss in the tuna, and you toss in extra olive oil, and you toss in a little black pepper and your cooked pasta. Let me tell you, so delicious. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We have Jeremy calling from Ann Arbor. Jeremy, what do you want to talk about?
I wanted to talk to you today about polenta croutons.
Oh, yeah.
My girlfriend, she was recently in the Upper East Side of New York City, and she called me and said, I had this awesome dinner at this restaurant, and they had polenta croutons. And it really got my gears grinding. But I couldn't really grasp the concept of polenta crouton. I was wondering, do I have to buy a deep fryer?
No. Oh, no. It's in that category of the many things that you do with leftover polenta. Because people who lived on polenta, you know, they'd make the polenta and they would thin slice it and grill it. They would pan fry it. They would, you know, rewarm it in the oven. They would thin slice it and layer it with all kinds of things and make something like a polenta lasagna. So it's really just leftover polenta, and you want stiff polenta. So because it when it cools down, it's going to be really firm. And the idea is that you cut it into small cubes. And you would toss it. You could either really saute it in a pan with olive oil and garlic and that kind of thing. Or you could toss it with, well, I'm just thinking olive oil, coarse salt, pepper, and put it on a big baking sheet in a hot oven. And every once in a while, you know, take a spatula under it and just toss it around. And that would be your crouton. So you'd make it kind of the way you would make a bread crouton.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it's very simple. The formula for polenta is usually, if you're going to make it from scratch, is 3 parts water to 1 part cornmeal. And the real trick to polenta that most people today don't get is everybody's serving raw polenta. It has to cook for a minimum of 45 minutes. Or I have a cheater's way of doing it because most people are not cooking it enough. What I do is I put 3 cups or 3 parts of boiling water, you know, from a kettle, into a big metal bowl, and I whisk in the polenta, and then I put that over a pot of boiling water, and then I just seal that bowl with like foil, and I forget about it for an hour and a half. I mean, every once in a while I go in and stir it a little, or I throw salt in it. But what happens is the polenta cooks thoroughly, and it cooks very slowly, and it gets sweet. It just tastes great. And then you've got polenta, and it'll keep in the fridge for 5 days. So, you know, you can put it on a baking sheet. You can cool it however you want. And then you cut it up and you make croutons.
Wow. Thanks for the information.
You are welcome. Oh, one other thing. Don't waste your money on imported Italian cornmeal. Yeah, no, seriously, I watch people, they're paying $7 a pound for cornmeal because it came from Italy. And the reality is it's stale. Cornmeal goes stale really fast. You want as fresh ground as you can get, and I usually buy mine in a co-op or, you know, a place that sells stuff where there's a lot of turnover. And there's a company in, it's a mill, really, as far as I understand, in San Francisco called Giusto's. And they have got the freshest polenta meal, and it's sold at places like Whole Foods. And it's a few pennies more a pound, but, you know, polenta's, cornmeal's not expensive. It's not like $10 a pound.
Okay.
And when you buy it, store it in the freezer. And that way you can, you know, you'll have it in great condition even if you hold it for 6 months.
Great.
Thanks for a great question.
All right. Thank you very much.
You take care, Jeremy.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. You know, this whole idea of everything that you do with leftover polenta, one thing you can do is cut it in sticks like French fries and deep fry it. I just throw that out as a thought. Anyway, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We've got Joshua calling from St. Paul. Joshua, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I don't need a specific answer to a specific cooking question. I've noticed that my desire for cooking has gone down immensely. We're talking about a guy who can spend 12 hours a day in the kitchen, which is what I used to do when I first came back to school, and I just was totally irresponsible with my time. And I think I'm cooked out. I do. I'm one of those guys. I don't make lasagna with store-bought noodles. You know, I make noodles from scratch all the time, and I never buy bread because I know I can bake it. And everything is from scratch with fresh ground spices, and I think I'm just out of steam.
You know, you sound like me, where I tend to go to the extremes. And yeah, you do burn out. You hit the wall. And so are you feeling like you really need to be perked up, or are you just saying, is this normal?
yeah, is this normal? And do you have, like, something new to try to kind of get me back in the swing? Mm-hmm. I noticed that hosting helps a little bit, but I'm still caught in this rut of not always wanting to make everything from scratch, but sometimes just wanting a quick meal, but yet knowing that I can do everything from scratch, so I shouldn't.
Welcome to my world. Yeah, I know. Yeah, you tend to set a pretty high standard, and you tend to feel guilty if you shortcut. But there's a real world out there. And the real world is we have to feed ourselves, and you know enough, probably know how to shortcut to get some good food in your body. Because there's a lot of simplicity out there. You know, there's a lot of really simple stuff that you can make that isn't going to require you starting with baking the bread. Mm. And you know, and what I'm thinking, I don't know why, but I always turn to Asian food because even though it can be incredibly complex, there is an immediacy there of satiation and ideas. And the idea of even a stir fry, a really simple stir fry, which happens fast and it captures a real sense of freshness when it's done right.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is, I think you're entitled to a break. You're allowed to go out and buy food somebody else made and feed yourself with it, and you'll get inspired again. I mean, you may want to step out of your comfort zone if you're looking for something. Like for me, for instance, when I get really burned out and yet I feel I want to keep my hand in, I'll turn to something I've never done before, whether it's a cuisine or a kind of cooking. Like, for instance, at this time of year, I always think I want to do old-time Americana, those old cookbooks from the 1800s that have these incredibly simple recipes. And some of them might be awful, but a lot of them are really good. Mm. Most of them are terribly unhealthy, and they're really interesting. But I don't know if I'm answering your question, yeah, but I'm mulling with you. You know, what attracts you right now?
What attracts me? Oh, I don't know. I think... Well, I've always just enjoyed cooking, you know, finding Greek and also other traditional Jewish foods. I mean, I'm not of Jewish descent, but
yeah. You know,
picking up that cookbook is definitely new and exciting. But I think you're onto something with trying something new, even if it's something maybe a little slightly processed, or sometimes I force myself to go out to eat just because, even though I may not get the best food, I think I'm going to get an idea.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. The worst food, well, not the worst food, but I mean, you can have a lot of very ordinary food but get a great idea from it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I love to eat out of my comfort zone in the sense I love to eat out in places where I know nothing about the cuisine.
Hmm.
So it may be Ethiopian. It may be Vietnamese. I'm now getting very familiar with, but I'm not an expert at it. It may be Korean. And, you know, you don't have to be an expert on it. Just go and enjoy it. But it'll work on your imagination. It'll dig in there.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Take a shot.
Well, you're always very encouraging. Thank you for your time today, Lynn.
Hey, you're welcome. And I know what burnout's about. Thou shalt not feel guilty.
Good plan.
Hey, enjoy. I'll probably see you at the local Korean place.
Oh, I hope so. Bye.
Okay, take care. Why you'd want to smell like your dessert has always escaped me, but perfumes like peach, pear, pineapple sell like crazy. Well, now you can smell like your cheese course. The people who make England's blue, dare I say slightly stinky, Stilton cheese have come out with a perfume. It's called Eau de Stilton. And I have Shazia Awan on the line. She is from the Stilton Cheesemakers Association. Shazia, welcome.
Thank you very much. Hello there.
Well, a blue cheese perfume, I can't resist. What are you guys thinking of? This is amazing.
Well, you know, there are so many, you know, Stilton cheese lovers out there that we really wanted to do something for the real cheese lovers. And we wanted to do something really unusual. And this year we launched a campaign called Stick on the Stilton, which is basically showing how easy blue Stilton cheese is to just stick onto everyday foods.
Right.
And we just wanted to do something really quirky to show that, look, you can stick it on your food, you can stick it on your pizza, on your jacket potato, and you can stick it on yourself as well. And it's actually quite nice.
Behind your ear.
Well, this is it, behind your ears, you know, on a romantic night out, why not? So it was just a bit of fun, but, you know, it's actually really taken off, and we've been approached by various perfume companies from across the world, really, to see if we can supply them with the perfume. I mean, at the moment, it's still in the trial stages, but the response that we've had from the general public has been phenomenal, absolutely
really?
Phenomenal. Yeah.
Does it actually smell like the cheese?
Well, I've actually got some on at the moment. I've been wearing it, and I've not had any complaints from any of the men in the office. It's got base notes of blue Stilton cheese. And then the other smells in there are clary sage, and sort of valerian, angelica seed, and yarrow, all English-sourced ingredients.
If you'll pardon the expression, it almost sounds palatable.
Almost, but now, not quite.
I understand that you folks had approached a very popular host, a British TV host named Kat Dealey.
We have indeed.
And has she accepted to become spokesperson for the cheese?
Well, we've not, not as yet, but fingers crossed. I mean, the reason we chose Kat Dealey is because she's a Midlands girl, and blue Stilton cheese can only be made in 7 dairies. In the Midlands in the UK.
Right.
We wanted to use her to sort of bring a touch of glamour to Stilton cheese.
Well, now I'm thinking, if you've got the Stilton perfume, is there going to be Stilton sort of room spray and Stilton soap and Stilton hand lotion?
As it is, you know, we've just got Stilton perfume. I mean, we had quite a few emails from men saying, oh, when are you going to do a Stilton cologne as well? So no plans just as yet.
Well, yet another thing and something we might notice immediately that separates the British from the rest of the world.
Indeed.
And makes you folks unique. I think this is fascinating.
Indeed.
Hey, thanks for talking with us.
Not a problem at all. Thank you very much.
Shazia Awan is from the Stilton Cheesemakers Association. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Mark E. Smith. He said, blue cheese contains natural amphetamines. Why aren't students informed about this? The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. And you can download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. Sign up for both, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Hefty, maker of the Hefty OneZip, a food storage bag designed so that the rest of the family can close it. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.